Hello, and welcome to The Rounds Table, a weekly podcast about major new research in medicine hosted online at healthydebate.ca. My name is Amol Verma. I'm a resident in internal medicine at the University of Toronto. And today I'm joined by Nathan Zilbert, who is a senior resident in general surgery at the University of Toronto. Hey, Nathan, how's it going?
I'm doing great, Amol. How are you?
Just dandy. So Nathan and I today are talking about two highly relevant clinical topics. I'm actually very excited about our subjects today. The first is a trial in the New England Journal of Medicine comparing transfusion strategies after cardiac surgery. And the second is a study published in JAMA about managing intracranial bleeding in patients on oral anticoagulants. Okay, Nathan, kick us off. Talk to us about transfusion after cardiac surgery.
All right, Amol. Thank you very much. So I'm going to talk to you about the Transfusion Indication Threshold Reduction Trial. That's abbreviated T2TRE2.
The Titer 2 trial? I think it's Titer 2.
They've done what you have to do to get into the New England Journal and come up with this great acronym that Amol likes. And the background of this is that, as you might expect, cardiac surgery patients are frequently transfused postoperatively, and there's some debate in the literature about the benefit or harm of a more restrictive transfusion strategy. And as has been shown in a lot of different clinical settings, generally speaking, studies show that a restrictive strategy usually results in better outcomes, including better mortality. And these investigators from the United Kingdom attempted to answer this question in cardiac surgery patients. So they randomized patients who had had cardiac surgery and who ended up with a hemoglobin level below 90 to either a restrictive or a liberal transfusion strategy. And their primary outcome was looking at vascular complications or infectious complications, and they actually showed those were similar between the two groups, occurring in about a third of patients. They also showed similar rates of ICU stays and pulmonary complications, kidney failure, but they did also show that the liberal transfusion group had a lower mortality, which is different from other trials, 2% compared to 4% in the restrictive strategy. So what do you think, Amol?
It sounds like this is a bit of a replication of the various studies that have happened about liberal versus restrictive transfusion strategies. Tell me what's different about this trial than some of the other trials that have been done.
Well, one thing that stood out to me was the indication for randomization and the hemoglobin thresholds that were used between the two groups. So as I mentioned, the hemoglobin level that you needed to have to be randomized in the trial or be eligible for the trial was 90, and that was the threshold used in the liberal transfusion group. The restrictive transfusion group, they used a hemoglobin level of 75. So comparing to the TRIC trial, where I believe the numbers were 170, that was one difference that stood out to me.
I agree with you that it is different that they chose 90 and 75. So most trials in this realm have chosen 100 as the upper target and 70 as their lower threshold. So anyway, they're sort of in the ballpark, but I kind of wonder, do you think this reflects the overall trend of practice moving away from liberal transfusion so that, you know, the upper limit is 90 instead of 100, so that you're already sort of moving towards a more conservative transfusion strategy?
I mean, I think it's certainly a reasonable explanation for that, for sure. I mean, it also, though, makes it somewhat harder to compare these results to other studies, in addition to the fact that it is a different patient population, but perhaps it does show some overall evolution in clinical practice.
Right, okay. And so similar to basically all of the other major trials in this area, they found no difference between the two groups in terms of their primary outcome, right? That's basically been the finding in all of these trials, is that liberal versus restrictive transfusion strategies, whether your primary outcome is mortality or function after hip fracture surgery, they tend to basically show that there's no difference in the primary outcome.
That's right. And this study was no exception in that regard. However, this study's primary outcome was not mortality, as it was in some of these other trials. It was this hodgepodge of both infectious and vascular complications.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting choice of composite endpoints and their primary outcomes. So do you want to just list them quickly and we can talk a little bit more deeply about it?
So the outcomes that were listed included an infectious event, and then they had sort of subcategories of either sepsis or wound infection. And then ischemic events were broken down to myocardial infarction, strokes, and ischemic bowel. And then also different grades of acute kidney injury, which they also grouped under ischemic events.
Yeah, so my initial instinct at looking at this primary outcome is that it seems to kind of balance the benefits and the harms of transfusion within the single primary outcome. So, you know, the harms associated with transfusions would be things like increased infectious complications, whereas the benefits would be less infarction and less ischemic complications, theoretically. So combining those endpoints into a composite primary outcome seems to me to be a little bit counterintuitive.
I'd be inclined to agree with you. However, in looking at their data, not only did they show that the overall combined outcome of vascular and infectious complications was the same between the two groups, they also broke it down in each of these categories, both overall infectious and overall vascular, as well as for each of the subtypes that we just mentioned, and they were actually similar between the two groups. So it's not like there's a counterbalancing of more ischemic events in one group and more vascular events in the other.
Yeah, just looking at the subcategories within that composite outcome, they're basically numerically the same. So so much for my brilliant critique of the study. But
better luck next time. We have one more paper to discuss. So.
Oh, okay. I'll try to bring my A game. So I guess the primary outcome in most of the other trials, or at least in three of the other major trials that I know about in this area. So the TRIC trial was looking at ICU patients and comparing transfusion strategies. There was the trial on upper GI bleeding, and then there was a study in 2011 that looked at hip fracture patients who had a history of cardiovascular disease. In pretty much all of those studies, mortality was the primary endpoint, and I guess you can do that because those are higher risk patient populations where you would have a frequent enough mortality rate that you could use that as your primary endpoint. I guess in the cardiac surgery population, and this was largely elective cardiac surgery, although there was some emergent surgery, mortality is going to be a lot lower. Is that right?
Well, absolutely. I mean, in this trial, looking at the 2,000 patients that, you know, were the subset that were more anemic, overall mortality rate in the two groups were 2% and 4%, certainly much lower than you would find in the GI bleed or ICU or elderly post hip fracture patient population, I think, for sure. So I think, you know, while it's a valid point to raise that this primary outcome doesn't allow us to compare to these other trials, it's just, I think, a fact of life dealing with this particular clinical question of cardiac surgery patients, that you're going to need to have a ton of patients in order to have a probably adequately powered mortality trial. And this seems to be, you know, a pretty valiant effort to enroll a large number of patients in over a dozen centers in one large health system. So
maybe we can get into talking about who exactly were the patients that were enrolled in this study. What kind of surgery did they have?
So these were all adult mostly elective cardiac surgery patients. 40% of them were undergoing CABG procedures, 30% valve procedures. They didn't break down in too much more detail, the types of valve procedures being performed. And then there were 20% having combined CABG and valve procedures, and then a much smaller percentage having aortic arch operations.
You said there was about 2,000 patients in the study?
Yeah.
And what did they look like? Were they old? Were they young? Did they have a lot of comorbidity?
So they, on average, were 70 years old, and about two-thirds were male. And they had, I think as you would expect, significant rates of cardiac comorbidities. So about 45% of them had class 2 heart failure, just under 30% had class 3 heart failure, large rates of angina, and then reasonable rates of diabetes and previous strokes as well.
Okay, so let's talk about the two, I think, surprising findings from this study, both of which emerge from secondary endpoints. So why did they find more death, which was sort of unexpected? And can we believe it?
Well, I mean, it's a secondary endpoint. So you can take that with a grain of salt. And I mean, I guess as a statistical purist would probably say we should neither believe the finding nor necessarily believe its opposite either, because it's probably underpowered to answer the question. But I mean, I think at the same time, intuitively, we probably can make a reasonable jab at explaining why that would be the case in this patient population of vascular disease, that having increased oxygen-carrying capacity would actually improve their postoperative course.
So it's possible that having slightly higher hemoglobin levels is better in this patient population. Though, interestingly, it's not like they were having more heart attacks in the restrictive transfusion group, that there wasn't really a significant difference in that outcome. So hard to know exactly what it was that mediated the death, right?
Right.
So the second interesting finding was about kidney injury. So it seemed that in the group that had more restrictive transfusions, there was a higher rate of kidney injury. And maybe this plays a little bit more into the adverse outcomes, particularly relating to death that we saw. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so they did find that when they assessed the patient's postoperative creatinine levels, that those in the restrictive transfusion strategy did have higher rates of acute kidney injury compared to those in the liberal strategy. And that was one of the differences between the two groups in the subgroup analysis.
I think one of the major takeaway points for me from this is, you know, pretty much all the other studies moved in the same direction, that restrictive transfusion is better. And this is a bit of a cautionary tale to say, you know, don't necessarily overgeneralize that. And, you know, one of the population of patients in whom this remains an unanswered question is patients with coronary artery disease, and trying to figure out what's the appropriate transfusion threshold for those patients. But it does seem like it's probably a little bit higher than for the general non-coronary artery disease patient population.
Right. And how much higher, I think, obviously still outstanding, and still probably depends on, you know, even just having coronary artery disease is, you know, whether you're having cardiac surgery or whether you're having a GI bleed or whether you're admitted to hospital for another reason, you know, there may be different appropriate transfusion triggers in those situations, even for people with that medical history.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe then to just close on this point of appropriate transfusion triggers, one of the facts that I found the most striking from both the introduction of this paper and the editorial about the paper that was written by John Spertus in the New England Journal was this finding that there's dramatic variability in transfusion rates in cardiac surgery at different institutions, ranging from between 5% to 90% of patients being transfused, depending on the institution.
Yeah, no question. And I think, you know, for those institutions that are probably already practicing a very restrictive or a very liberal transfusion strategy in their centers, you know, this probably should be thought-provoking for them.
Yeah, and hopefully action-provoking.
Hopefully, that's well said.
Okay, so Nate, why don't you wrap up? Tell us what the major takeaway point is.
So the major takeaway point is that in this study looking at over 2,000 patients undergoing elective cardiac surgery, a liberal transfusion strategy was not better or worse in terms of a composite outcome of infection and vascular postoperative outcomes, but there was a suggestion that mortality is actually improved in the liberal transfusion strategy, which is a novel finding compared to a similar trial design being done in other patient populations. And I think this is both an interesting study and a good example of how we shouldn't overgeneralize high-profile trials to every clinical scenario that seems like it might be appropriate.
Okay, thanks very much. Let's move on. So I'm very excited to be talking about a study that I think has large number of very relevant clinical implications. This is the RETRACE study. It was published in JAMA, and it's about intracranial bleeding in patients who are on oral anticoagulants. So this study specifically tells us information about three topics. The first is how to limit the extent of bleeding in patients who have an intracranial bleed on oral anticoagulants. The second is on the outcomes associated with restarting oral anticoagulation after an intracranial bleed. And the third is on functional outcomes of these patients. So this was a retrospective cohort study in 19 hospitals in Germany, and they looked at patients who were all on warfarin, so only on vitamin K antagonists, no other type of oral anticoagulant. And they extracted data retrospectively from medical records and institutional databases. And then they followed these patients with questionnaires and phone interviews for 1 year after discharge.
So tell me about the types of patients that they were following up here.
Yeah, so they included consecutive adult patients who had a spontaneous intracranial bleed that were taking an oral anticoagulant, and they had to have an INR of greater than 1.5. And these were patients admitted between 2006 and 2010. They excluded patients who had an intracranial bleed secondary to some other provoking event. So if they had traumatic brain injury or cancer or other causes of intracranial hemorrhage, they were excluded. So it was only people with spontaneous intracranial bleeding.
Spontaneous intracranial bleeding on warfarin. Okay, so what did they find?
So really, I think we should talk about this in terms of three different sections. The first was really around extension of bleeding. So maybe before we jump into the results, let's talk about the types of patients that were included in the study. So the characteristics of these patients, they screened 10,000 patients, and they ended up enrolling about 1,100 patients. The types of patients they included, so they were 74 years old on average. The average INR at the time of inclusion was 2.8. Most of them, like 85% of them, had hypertension. 50% of them had coronary artery disease. A third had diabetes and strokes and kidney dysfunction. So a multi-morbid patient population.
And what were they being anticoagulated for?
Yeah, so the vast majority of them, about 75%, were being anticoagulated for atrial fibrillation. 10% had a mechanical heart valve, and another almost 10% had either a pulmonary embolus or deep vein thrombosis.
Okay.
And at admission, most of these patients were sick, but not terribly sick. So they had the average admission Glasgow coma scale was 14. So they were by and large alert. And that may speak a little bit to some selection bias on who they were able to consent and enroll in the study. So those are the patients that were included. So now let's talk about, I guess, their three major findings. So their first goal was to predict what are the factors associated with limiting the enlargement of the hematoma or of bleeding. So pretty much all of the patients who presented got something to reverse their anticoagulation. The vast majority of them got prothrombin complex, what we refer to as octoplex here, and then sometimes with some combination of either vitamin K or fresh frozen plasma. So they found really three factors that were very modifiable, that were strongly associated with reducing the extent of bleeding. The first was they had been reversed within 4 hours. So the anticoagulation had been reversed within 4 hours. The second was the extent of anticoagulation reversal. So the first was the timing of the anticoagulant reversal. The second was the extent of anticoagulation reversal. And they found that if the INR was less than 1.3, that had the best predictive outcome. And reversing the INR below 1.3 didn't help that much more. So really, 1.3 seemed to be the ideal cutoff. And then the third was blood pressure control. So having a blood pressure of less than 160 was much more likely to be associated with a lower rate of bleeding. And they found that when all three of these features were met, so if they had an INR less than 1.3 and anticoagulation reversed within 4 hours and a systolic blood pressure of less than 160, only 18% of those patients had hematoma enlargement, whereas 44% had it in the rest of the cohort. So that was an absolute risk reduction of 26%, and in fact, a 7% absolute reduction in-hospital mortality.
So I have a couple questions. So, you know, when I read through this and these illustrious authors suggested that correcting a coagulopathy quickly and controlling someone's systolic blood pressure was going to be the main factors that affect hematoma progression in someone with a hemorrhagic stroke, my reaction was, well, thanks so much. That sounds sort of obvious to me. You know, I can, you know, imagine that in the emergency department, when someone comes in with acute neurological changes and they think they're having a stroke and they get a CAT scan and an INR and they make this diagnosis, these are the things that are instituted right away. So I wonder what we're really learning from those data.
Yeah, so, you know, it sounds pretty obvious that you should reverse the anticoagulation and you should control the blood pressure, and that will be good for intracranial bleeding. One of the important things to know, though, is that we have very limited evidence about this very fact. So most of the recommendations around managing oral anticoagulant-associated intracranial bleed are based largely on consensus, expert consensus. And so there's no data to back it up. And there's all sorts of things in medicine that seemed very obvious, which turned out not to be beneficial for patients. For example, having a higher hemoglobin level. And so, you know, having data to suggest that these things are in fact beneficial is really important.
All right. So why don't we move on to the second outcome that they were looking at, resuming oral anticoagulation.
Yeah, so this is the other, I think, really important area of controversy, and it's certainly something as an internist that I'm often left dealing with on the ward is a patient who has had a spontaneous intracranial bleed. They were on an oral anticoagulant, and now what do I do? So this study followed up patients 1 year after their admission. They were able to follow up 720 patients or so, so that was about 60% of their patient population. And in that patient group, they found that oral anticoagulant was restarted in about a quarter of them, 24%. They found that the average time to resumption was about 30 days. So most people were started about a month after their bleed. And what they found is that at 1 year, there were fewer ischemic complications in those who restarted anticoagulation than in those who didn't. So 5% versus 15% in those who did not restart oral anticoagulation. And they found that there was no difference in bleeding between the two groups, 8% versus 6.6%.
What do you think about that? Do you think that's surprising?
I do think it's a little bit surprising, particularly in the light of the general body of literature about intracranial bleed following a spontaneous bleed in the brain having restarted oral anticoagulants. You know, while we would certainly be, you're nervous to restart someone on oral anticoagulant, you know, the weight of the literature tends to suggest that it might be safe to restart them. Of course, it's really, you know, you're weighing the benefit of preventing an ischemic event, which it seems that you're likely to do if you're on an anticoagulant and you're at high risk of having an ischemic event. So, for example, in this atrial fibrillation cohort, their average CHAD score, the CHAD score was greater than 2 in like 80% of their cohort. So high risk of having an ischemic event, complication of their atrial fibrillation. But how do you balance that against the possibility of having certainly a more severe intracranial bleed if you're on or blood thinners than if you're not?
Do we know the CHAD score of the patients who they chose not to restart anticoagulation on?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So, you know, obviously the big limitation here is indication bias, which is that the people who were restarted on oral anticoagulation were probably less sick than the people who were not restarted on oral anticoagulation. So to try to get around that, they propensity matched the people who were restarted on oral anticoagulation to a control group within the people who were not restarted. So they sort of matched them along all of the factors that they had measured. And they found basically the same finding, which was less stroke in the group that was started on oral anticoagulation, less ischemic stroke, and no difference in recurrent intracranial bleed, which was about 4% per 100 patient years in both groups.
I mean, it seems to me that this decision is a much more, I would say, nuanced, you know, having to sort of weigh things with the patient and get a sense of what they can tolerate in terms of their own comfort. I would think that for clinicians looking after this problem, having some statistics and evidence would be very helpful to help educate patients on this. And it sounds like maybe with at least the propensity match data, they, you know, this paper gives them some of that.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I think what's important, so two things. One is, I think we absolutely need a prospective, probably randomized control trial to try to answer this question, because the current degree of data just can't, the current quality of data. So the last point to make is that people who have this problem of intracranial bleeding associated with oral anticoagulants have very poor functional outcomes. I guess somewhat unsurprising, but even I was a little bit impressed by this finding. So they found that, first of all, mortality was 30% at hospital discharge and 56% at 1 year. And then they found that the vast majority of patients had unfavorable functional outcomes, 80% at discharge and only 73% at 1 year. So only about 6% sort of improved their functional outcome over the course of a year. So, you know, this is likely to be associated with extremely high rates of morbidity and mortality with this problem.
Well, I guess you're right. That's it's a good point, but also perhaps not too surprising. I did have one question I wanted to get your comment on just while we wrap up is, you know, given the explosion of new oral anticoagulants other than warfarin, and it seems to me that warfarin is now becoming, for many patient populations, a second or third choice oral anticoagulant. How do you sort of speak to the relevance of this paper, given that that was the only agent that they were using? What maybe is still relevant, and what might be missing in 2015?
Yeah, absolutely. So a couple of points there. One is that, you know, many patients, if not the majority of patients, are probably still on warfarin, while that will certainly change in the years to come. So for now, it's still extremely relevant to day-to-day practice. The second point about oral anticoagulants and intracranial hemorrhage. So what do we know? We know that new oral anticoagulants have lower rates of bleeding in the brain, but we also know that new oral anticoagulants are more difficult to reverse. But totally agree with you that this study, you know, is limited in the ability to comment on that patient population. So, you know, within the limitations of this retrospective study, in which there was selection bias in terms of who was enrolled in the study because consent was required. So, you know, the sickest and the healthiest of patients tend to be excluded in that context. And people who have do not treat orders, you know, don't necessarily get follow-up imaging. And so there's a lot of bias inherent in this study. And then, you know, there is some indication bias in who gets restarted on oral anticoagulants. There are some really clinically valuable findings. The first is that in people who do have warfarin-associated intracranial bleeding, the goals should be, at least based on this study, an INR of less than 1.3 at 4 hours and a systolic blood pressure of less than 160 within 4 hours of admission. And two, it may not be harmful to restart oral anticoagulants in patients who are at high risk of ischemic events, and it may in fact even be beneficial, and certainly more prospective data is necessary to try and answer some of these questions more strongly. Okay, let's move on, Nathan, and talk about our good stuff segment. So Nate, what caught your attention from the world of medicine this week?
So this past week, I read Atul Gawande's latest book called...
In 1 week? Impressive.
Actually, in one day, one quick plane ride down to a conference. And it is a very easy and quick read. So another reason why I think our listeners might be able to fit it into their busy schedules. But I think this likely, in my opinion, is his best book. It's called Being Mortal. And it explores end-of-life care, geriatrics, palliative care, and issues like that in sort of modern Western society. I think he does a great job both reviewing medical literature, discussing elder care in Western society, comparing it to sort of